aquí en el Caribe. Gozo mi rumba y con mi salsa la gente vive.
Míralo, pero con el chévere de la salsa.
Family, if you haven't already, I invite you to tune in to one of KPFK's strongest traditions, our Spanish language slate, airing Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight. A rich mix of public affairs, environmental justice, immigration news, deep dives into Latin America, and of course, music that moves the soul. It's community radio at its finest, an español for la comunidad. So tell a friend, spread the word, and listen in Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. Familia, les tengo una invitación especial.
Hi, this is Ricky Lee Jones. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM LA, 98.7 Santa Barbara.
Thank you. You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next,
we'll present the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. She's Beautiful explores the emergence of a political thought that challenged systems of patriarchy. This documentary provides important historical insight at a time when our country is experiencing regression around issues of reproductive rights, equity in the workplace, and violence against women.
You're not allowed to retire from women's issues. You still have to pay attention because somebody's trying to yank the rug out from under you. And that's what's happening now.
The feminists who are here tonight, do you not believe a woman's place is in the home, right?
As feminists, what we believe in is very simple, and that is the social, economic, and political equality of the sexes. Because the relationship between the sexes is, in fact, a political relationship. We're an oppressed group, and we have been through history. We have to.
If you do something as remarkable as changing the relationship between the sexes, everything is at risk, every possible idea. And many people don't like it, especially men don't like it. They're very threatened by it.
Women's Lib really is a lot of insignificant people that are really trying to gain their own interests and boost their own ego by making brash statements or being on television or what have you.
You're so oversensitive, Audie. Why are you so sensitive?
We don't like being so sensitive. It's not pleasant. We don't like having to always be catching things. We'd rather they didn't exist. But as long as people are going to be insensitive to our position, we're going to have to keep correcting them because there's no other way to change the consciousness.
Women, given their educational status, can earn 60% of what men of the same education can. What that really means is that a woman with college education, BA, earns what a man does who has 3 years of high school. This is economic discrimination and exploitation.
Women as well as men told me I was wrong over and over again. Women are not oppressed. Or what does it matter? Who cares? You have a lot of influence. You were working against cultural norms. You're working against institutions.
How do you feel about women's liberation?
Woman's place is more at home than to advance herself too much.
Totally against it. I feel I don't know what they're being liberated from.
Many women protested that they like cooking and housework and catering to men. But I would argue with some woman who was being extremely defensive about the movement and then 6 months later would run into her at a demonstration.
Prior to the women's liberation movement, most women were conditioned to meet the needs and expectations of men. But the introduction of this new feminist thought allowed women to view themselves as full human beings, equally capable of defining themselves and deciding their own paths. As the civil rights movement dominated the world center stage, women weren't content with being excluded from the conversations of resistance and liberation. Their issues needed to be prioritized as well. Activist Frances Beale.
The Black Liberation Movement had come into its fore, and you're talking about liberation and freedom half the night on the racial side, and then all of a sudden men are going to turn around and start talking about putting you in your place.
If you don't want any trouble.
That was the contradiction in terms that we were no longer prepared to put up with. So 1968, we founded the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee to take up some of these issues.
A number of women felt that we need to go off on our own and focus on what we needed to do in our fight for liberation.
I was a graduate student at Berkeley. One day I saw a little 3x5 card in the student union, and it said a women's group forming. And these consciousness-raising groups spontaneously grew up in many areas of the country.
When I first heard about the Women's Liberation Movement, I had two little kids under 5. My connection with the world was, I felt, finished. During one of my crises of feeling that my life was over, I heard some young women talking about meetings they were having, and they were talking about women's liberation, and they gave the address of a meeting. So I went to this meeting, and there were these women talking about their lives as I had never imagined people could.
Well, you need to be specially trained to be a housewife. You get married, their whole new set of rules. We still have to look a certain way and be a certain way. But there's a whole lot.
We went around the room, and people asked a very simple question. How would your life have been different if you had been a boy?
Why do you think being a woman might limit you as a human being, your possibilities, you know?
Welfare people and whatnot.
We challenged concepts of masculinity. We challenged concepts of femininity. We talked about skin color, how young black women would put cream on in order to make themselves light-skinned.
Suddenly, everything was up for questioning. Women did all of the family and housework and cooking, and the men got to make the living and get all of the attention in the world. Why was that?
Like, we don't even realize what goes on until we sit and compare with other women.
And we heard each other. We heard each other into speech. You could sense it. You could feel it. You could cut it with a knife, as they say. The room was electric with whatever was going to be shared.
So I said, I've had 3 abortions, and the last one was within the last year. And I started to cry because I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that what I had considered personal embarrassment was something that was part of this whole larger experience.
The big insight of the women's movement was the personal is political. Problems that you felt were happening to you alone probably were your fault. But if it's happening to other people, then it's a social problem and not just a personal problem.
The framing of women's oppression as a societal construct put all the daily personal challenges that women faced into a new broad context. For the first time, women were openly broaching subjects that generations before were too fearful to speak of. Women were demanding the right to control their own bodies and lives without permission from men or the state.
Thousands of women in the United States are hospitalized each year because of post-abortion complications. 5,000 of these women die.
I had a very good friend in high school who went away to college, and she subsequently had an illegal abortion and died. So within 3 or 4 months of going off to college, she was dead.
People tried to self-abort. My best friend took pills, and she had the miscarriage in the dorm shower with the turned on really hard, hoping the noise would muffle her cries of pain.
Some were able to find an abortion. Some had to have the child that they didn't want. All those kinds of experiences we discovered were universal. And abortion became our big unifying issue.
Women have a fundamental right to control their own bodies and to control their own lives.
Not since the suffragettes fought for the right to vote has an issue been more critical to women than abortion.
Somewhere around 1970, I went to an abortion rights rally in San Francisco. And it was a sea of white women, very few women of color. And someone grabbed a bullhorn and asked for the African-American women who were there to gather under a tree. And we decided that we would form a group called Black Sisters United. I was very glad that, you know, somebody called African-American women together and said, you know, maybe we have something to talk about that might be a tiny bit different from what's coming from the stage. And indeed we did.
I was invited up to Harlem to speak at a event around abortion. Remember, in the Black Liberation Movement, the big debate is abortion is genocide, women should have babies for the revolution. And I remember going up those stairs and my knees were literally knocking because this was a bunch of nationalists and I was really scared. I concentrated a lot about the deaths of Black women as a result of illegal abortion and how we should be able to choose when we want to have children. So I managed to survive, you know, some of the attacks. And on my way out, twice it happened. One woman said to me, whispered to me, "Thank God you speak up. Thank God you're speaking up." And another, as I was approaching the door, said, "Right on. Right on."
Dear brothers, poor Black women decide for themselves whether to have a baby or not have a baby. Black women are being asked by militant Black brothers not to practice birth control because it's a form of whiteys committing genocide on Black people. Well, true enough. But Black women in the United States have to fight back out of our own experience of oppression, and having too many babies stops us from teaching them the truth, from supporting our children, and from stopping the brainwashing, as you say, and fighting Black men who still want to use and exploit us.
It was very difficult for middle-class white women to have any conception about what was going on in communities of color. And those differences could have been in conversation with each other, but if there isn't even an acknowledgement that there's differences in experience and perspective, and the voice of one is used as the voice of all, then you have a problem.
That was during a period when Black women did not particularly identify with the women's movement.
Mrs. Norton, why are you a Black woman involved in women's liberation?
I'm involved in the struggle for women's rights because I believe women are disadvantaged. Black women are no less than white women. Indeed, Black women far more than white women. Women who have spent their lives working in other women's kitchens have a different kind of handicap than women who have been oppressed for their sex in other ways.
We were grappling with that idea of how do you integrate race, class, and gender. That's the reason why we had some reservations about the term feminism, because feminism was just seemed to be dealing with the female aspect of your being.
It's important to keep in mind that Black women are organized in their own organizations, in their own version of Black women's liberation.
In 1964, a friend mentioned that his sister was pregnant and nearly suicidal. Could I do anything about it? And I was referred through a series of connections to a doctor. Asked him if he would perform an abortion. He said yes. And a few weeks later, someone else called and said they also were looking for an abortion. The word had spread. And at that point, I decided to set up a bit of a system. I was living in a dormitory at the time. And so I told people to ask for Jane. I could tell within the first minute what they were calling about, because there was a pause, there was a hesitance, there was a tension. Many were frightened, because three people discussing an abortion in those days was a conspiracy to commit felony murder.
Jane was this service that was established in Chicago that provided abortions when abortion was illegal. We would have women call us who were in need of the abortion service. And, of course, having Jane available without having to refer them to the mob was a godsend.
The group would take in the calls, and we would do counseling. Then women would be brought to specific houses on a rotating basis. where the procedures would be done.
The service moved every day from somebody's home to somebody's home, which is quite amazing.
I joined the abortion service because I knew that women are sometimes desperate and they are going to hurt themselves in order to end their pregnancies. When I began Jane work, a few dozen women a week were coming through. After about 6 months, there were at least 100 women coming through. Ultimately, one really good abortionist taught Janes how to do abortions with skill and care, and then those Janes taught other Janes. All of us were always aware that what we were doing was illegal, that we could go to jail. You might have to throw everything in your bag and run down the back stairs at any moment. But we understood that it was important work, useful work, necessary work.
What is the relationship of the movement to the whole question of motherhood and the affection of mothers for children and so forth?
It's about being able to have children if you want them and being able not to have children if you don't want them. And if you want to have your kids in daycare centers, if you want to work, then you can do that too.
In the women's movement, the myth was that we hated men, we hated marriage, we hated children. That's not right. The group I was in, we talked mostly about childcare being the absolute precondition for women's emancipation.
One of the earliest battles was for child care. It's a now statement of purpose. We knew that women could not hold jobs and be promoted until society recognized its obligation to help take care of our children.
And I remember at some of the early demonstrations, those who had kids, we would bring the kids. And people would say things like, oh, we can't talk with you nursing the babies and stuff like that. And we would say, show us the daycare center. We'll be happy to bring the kids to the daycare center.
Feminists are accused of wanting women out of the home and leaving children come what may.
We proclaim that when we talk about 24-hour child care, we mean to have it.
After a great deal of work where feminists were in the leadership, we got close to having a real child care system.
In 1971, amazingly enough, the women's movement, the Congress, the Senate, passed a comprehensive child care act. Most historians don't even remember that. Forget about the rest of society. And President Nixon vetoed it. He said, we don't want to make our women like Soviet women. We want women to take care of their own children.
That was a tragic moment in history. And we've been paying for it ever since. It's one thing for women to pay the price. It's another thing for generations of children to pay the price as well. I can think of, frankly, of no more important issues that early feminists raised than educational child care.
Poor people, black women, women on welfare, are often sterilized against their will. I mean, that's been known to happen.
The same hospital that wants to sterilize the black women will not let a middle-class white woman be sterilized. If she says, I don't want to have any more children, they say, you have to
be crazy.
You've got to tell me. You have to have a medical reason. You have to be sick. There has to be something wrong with you.
Those things are two ends of the same dimension. It's still the issue of control over one's body, whether it's the right to have children if you want them, or the right not to.
In Puerto Rico, over one-third of the women on the island have been sterilized. That means over one-third of the women are never going to be able to hold a baby in their arms.
Women in Puerto Rico were used as guinea pigs, as a way of controlling the population. And then with that sterilization program being brought to New York City, we actively organized raising the consciousness about this.
The Young Arts Party was dedicated to issues affecting Puerto Ricans in the United States. We were the first ones to begin to articulate an idea of reproductive justice. It's just as important for women in our communities to be able to have children, raise children that don't go hungry, have daycare, as well as have access to birth control and the right to a safe abortion. The kind of developing feminism that we had in the Young Lords was make very clear decision not to separate, to wage struggle internally with our brothers. The men had written this program. One of the points dealt with revolutionary machismo. What an oxymoron. We weren't having it. So we formed a women's caucus and made demands on the men in the organization. It was ultimately changed to, we want equality for women, down with machismo and male chauvinism. It was important that it's not just women making that statement. It should be men saying, yo, brother, that's really a macho attitude you're taking. You need to check your... And that's what happened.
You're listening to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr. This is Making Contact. Subscribe to our podcast or sign up for updates by logging on to our website at radioproject.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Now back to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry.
One evening in my Tuesday night consciousness raising group, West Village One of New York Radical Feminists, Diane Crothers walked in with a newspaper, It Ain't Me Babe, from San Francisco, and said, there's an article here we all have to read. And it was a story about a woman in Marin County who'd been raped during a hitchhike. We read the article and we went around the room, and it turned out one woman, Sarah, had been raped. And the police said to her, who'd want to rape you?
A friend of mine was raped at knife point in her bed in off-campus housing. I went with her to the Student Health Service, and she was given a lecture on her promiscuity.
It was very common in a courtroom to blame the woman for the rape. And rape was looked at as a crime that occurred because a man had strong sexual urges that he couldn't satisfy any other way. No. And it was only with the feminist women that it came out that rape is not a crime of passion. It's a crime that expresses the urge to dominate.
People were not used to thinking of rape as a political crime against women. That was our slogan. Rape is a political crime against women.
I think the most profound thing that feminism did for me was to make me feel that I was capable of genuine freedom. Before the women's movement, I had my own work. I knew I wasn't going to live a traditional woman's life. I felt that I probably wasn't going to have children. And ultimately, I did have my daughter. And I think, were it not for feminism, I don't think I could have done that.
Right after I got out of college, it was November 2006, my mother passed away, and I got all of these letters and emails from her friends, her colleagues, all of the feminists that started Women's Liberation Movement. And I started to realize that even though I was down with the word feminism, I didn't really know what it meant to me and to our generation. I think the sexism that we experience is a little bit more insidious, and it's harder to sort of point out and say, see, that's sexism. But I know a lot of young kick-ass feminists out there. They're blogging, they're out in the streets, they're organizing.
What do you do when you're under attack?
Stand up, fight back!
What do you do when you're under attack?
Stand up, fight back!
The problem is rapists, and we need to address the problem. And let me give you a hint, it's not our clothes. It's not.
There's this new movement called Slut Walk that has now swept 70 different cities. And it was started by a young woman who heard a cop say about a woman who was raped, well, she was asking for it, she was dressed like a slut.
Believe it or not, people are assaulted regardless of what they wear. Some people who get raped are in burqas.
NYPD rape is a felony!
We created a revolution that we are still debating in our society. We're still arguing over many issues that women raised 40 years ago, like abortion, like childcare. We still don't have any child care.
In terms of reproductive health, reproductive justice, we've gone backward in a big way.
The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bowl, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Welcome to Women's History Month. For nearly 40 years, March has been designated as a month to celebrate and honor the achievements of women throughout history. And today we're talking about why it still matters and how it has changed and grown over the years. And of course, in this political moment with the current Trump regime and diversity, equity, and inclusion being attacked and canceled all over the place, why Women's History Month is more important than ever. We are joined today by Martha Wheelock, who is a longtime educator, documentary filmmaker, and current president of the National Women's History Alliance. Welcome to Feminist Magazine, Martha.
Well, thanks for having me, Lynn. I have a long history with Feminist Magazine. You do a great job there.
Well, thank you. We're very happy to have you with us. And in the midst of all this horrifying deluge that we've been getting of executive orders, we haven't actually heard much about how Women's History Month has been effectively canceled by Trump's executive order of the end of January, the sort of doublespeak, which to curtail diversity, equity, inclusion. I think many women don't actually realize that women's rights are part of DEI. Never mind the intersectional, of course, you know, component of Black women, LGBTQ women, everybody, disabled women, everyone else who's doubly affected in that sense. But it seems that all the federal agencies have just gone ahead and interpreted his executive order and negated Women's History Month along with Black History Month, Pride Month, etc. Where are we with all of this?
And one of the things that I get such a charge out of that has progressed since we founded basically the Women's History Project, sort of lobbied for it and founded, and by 1970 got the month with Bella Abzug and Jimmy Carter and all of that stuff, is that people love Black History Month and Women's History Month. And if you notice, corporations even start to celebrate it, and you get special programming from your public radio station, and even the bus tours in New York, they put signs up. So they kind of get a charge out of doing it. And by charge, I mean it's something for them to think about, for any organization to think about. That this is something special, special month. And it shouldn't be. It should be every day, of course. But one of the things you just said is how has it expanded? And as women gain more and more rights, now they're celebrating the Women's Basketball League, you know, and the right to equal pay back in the soccer days. So the reminder, I think, of Women's History Month and the evolution and the progress, I think people get this kind of collective enthusiasm about it as well, you know. And we wish today we even little people who don't know women's history say Happy Women's History Month, you know. And so it does some good, and that's probably very threatening to you know who.
Right.
And notice that when people ask me why do we need Women's History Month, what happened to Male History Month? Right, and this is the first point that we need to bring to when you look at the holidays of the year. There's not one woman honored, except Mother. Yeah, mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. All the rest of them are men. Juneteenth, which is of course going to be banned pretty soon because that's specialized to another group. But there's just no other way to kind of bring attention to it. Not to mention the fact that there's no women's sculptures, really. Finally, there was one put up in Central Park of real women, you know. So it's a subtle movement, but I really get a kick out of it when people say that they one year they don't know about women's history and the next year they do. So
yeah, it's like an opening of consciousness, and I always forget, and then when I come back to Women's History Month programming every year, I'm reminded that this actually all started in 1978 right here in California, in Sonoma, with the very first Women's History Week. So yay, California, we get to take that credit. But I mean, one of the things that we talk about with, you know, any marginalized or dismissed group is, you know, representation, right? And there's that phrase, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So there's that whole aspect and the reminder. But in your work with the National Women's History Alliance, there's actually a theme, right? And it's a theme that teachers, educators use. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that's great, because you say, what women's history is just so big that we kind of try like one year we honored women in science and women in business and women in sports and women in the arts, and that kind of like helps us to ground this in little projects for people, and it doesn't feel so overwhelming, because it's overwhelming because it has never been told, and there's so many stories that need to happen.
Right.
This year we're honoring the fact that women working together. Women who educate and inspire generations. In other words, why we need a first this or a first that, or why a teacher has so much to give her students in terms of women's history. And that's where it really started, actually, with Women's History Month, is that a student asked Molly Murphy McGregor, who was one of the co-founders, who's this Susan B. Anthony? You know,
right.
Molly said, I don't know how that works. And I remember as a teacher even that somebody asked about what was a consciousness raising group, because I can go back that far. So I had to really do a lot of catch up. And my generation never heard of anything. Maybe we heard about Susan B. Anthony, but not really. So I think about Women's History Month also as like Valentine's Day. You have to remember to send somebody that you love a Valentine's. And and Bella Abzug from New York was the one that helped sign it and got the more working. And then we look at the working class women, you know, the women in the factories, the women's the sales clerks and the cleaner people. And so why do they make history? Well, they make history because they influence their children, or they end up doing some very small thing that might not be considered grand, but it's really grand in the scope of living, you know?
Yeah, I'm always reminded, somebody mentioned, you know, Instagram has all of these various history accounts, which I think are the most sort of popular form of education, really, Instagram and TikTok. And you see a lot of women's history stuff pop up. And frequently, it doesn't have whole contexts, which is very frustrating. But it'll be something like, oh, don't forget Rosa Parks. And, you know, she sat at the front of the bus. And then there's sort of the myth, which I've actually seen in children's books, that she just did it because she was tired that day. And it forgets this entire history of her organizing and how she was part of other organizing, including organizing for women's reproductive rights. And so I think it can't just be like, oh yeah, women did great things. It's like we have to see, as the theme is, how women move forward together, you know? And I think that that is currently very important to talk about for anybody who wants to resist what's going on, is the working collectively, right?
Right. And just to spin off of your Rosa Parks, so we see a first, so maybe it doesn't apply to me. But then I find some other speeches that somebody like Matilda Gage did or whatever. And all of a sudden, I'm empowered a little to use my voice. And the governor of Maine, Miller, anyway, she spoke up to Trump. And then the next day, the mayor of Boston, Healy, said, no, you can't force your laws down my throat. And where did they get their voice? They got their voice because things they heard before, and knowing that, and of course, the suffrage movement, Lynn, is probably one of the most inspiring things that anybody can know about. It's 72 years, 95 campaigns to do it, just persistence, just picking yourself up and getting going. And if women can learn, and women can do that so well, you know, they don't have to have instant success. They know that a child isn't a person until they're 18. You know, and what they learned, you know, by just showing up. And that's the recommendation they're giving us today. Show up to the marches, show up on your email, show up on your phone, keep hassling, you know, squeaky wheels get the grease.
Right. Yeah.
And we learn
keep
that.
Showing up.
And that's different from the civil rights movement, because there was violence there. This was a campaign with no violence whatsoever, direct action. And there was Alice Parks, Paul standing just with a sign, and she wouldn't give in. And that's a powerful sense of what women do and we have to do. And I take great inspiration from them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there are so many women who have been erased from history in so many places. There are women like, I just saw an article about a woman, Greek philosopher, who was the inspiration, and honestly, I'm forgetting her name, which is a sign of how women's history is erased, who was the inspiration to Plato and Socrates, and never acknowledged, never remembered, and these kinds of erasures of women who did firsts, and then men, it was sort of perceived that women didn't have the capacity to be educated or the capacity to be great artists or in all other various examples.
And then you take a field like science, by the way, which I think is really outstanding, because women couldn't be in science because that was close to God, and they didn't want women to get close to God because, you know, my gosh. And I love this. I can tell you this little quick story. Whooping cough, like measles, was a really big thing at one time,
right?
One generation, and there was no vaccine for it. And these two women who worked in public health up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, saw the mothers. They figured out from the children that they were handling that something was different, and they, to make a long story short, they got they figured out some things in their lab, and the men came in and said, "No, it's time to go home now, girls. You know, and that can't be valuable." And they dismissed them immediately, kept them out of the lab, but they snuck back in at night and developed this vaccine in 1930. And within 1 year, they say and they took a lot of grief for it. They saved 4,000 children from death that first year it was out. And of course, we don't know their names, do we? No. I happen to know them, but you know, Leverling and Everhart, and I should give it to you, but I can always give it if your readers, your listeners call in, we can have it ready for them. But and once again, that's the thing that we remember Jonas Salk of the polio, but this is just as important. Mm-hmm. And
we remember the
fight to do that.
We remember the quote, "great men of history," over and over again. So, from the educational side of things, for the National Women's History Alliance, you're inviting teachers to honor the contributions of key women educators and mentors and leaders. And I think that that's really key, the mentoring, the cross-generational conversations, right? And like what we can learn, and that it's not a, again, paternalistic, let's quote unquote use that word, but it's a two-way conversation always. Right.
And we think just what we learn from our mothers, probably more than anybody, you know, and all of us are teachers, you know, it doesn't have to be in a school, you know, it can be your aunt or somebody like that. And it also encourages us to find the stories within our families. You know, we always know our, you know, our patrilineal side, perhaps. And I just love that I found out that one of my great aunts was in the Lowell text mill, and so all of those kinds of things. And
you're right. And so, what books are you reading right now? What are you personally doing to celebrate in some way Women's History Month?
Oh, there's some wonderful. First of all, some of the best books about women are written for young adults.
Right?
You know, they're just wonderful. There's a book called "When I Marched with Susan B. Anthony." You know, and it's for seventh and eighth graders. Of course, you and I never had them, but there's some very lovely ones that I hope grandparents and mothers will read to their children as well. But anyway. I think the other genre that is really current for women's history are these historical women's novels. The novels that are written so easy to get into. They're not biographies, yet they are, but they tell the story, which is very important. One of the most marvelous book is The First Ladies, and it's the story of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mary Bethune, who a black and a white, and how Eleanor Roosevelt learned about racism from her and how that worked. And there was a lot of stories with Pauli Murray and Eleanor Roosevelt that just are wonderful. The story of Madam Secretary, the story of Frances Perkins, who got us the Social Security. There's a new book now called The Valiant Women who were in World War II. So any of the... And I go to Audible because I listen to books, and they have a whole category on women's history. And there's also a wonderful woman named Janice Daly, JANISDaly.com. She puts out a book a day of women's history of novels, and she's written her own novels herself. There's a movie coming out called The Women, about the nurses in Vietnam, by Christine Hannah, who's a major seller of New York Times seller. So start with a history book, a non-history book, which is a historic fiction. And I'm sure there's so many of them, and they're wonderful. And they're written by women, mostly. Mm-hmm. So women have finally grasped themselves and then delivered it out, you know. So
right. And I love that you put forward all these books that are like accessible and entertaining, you know, not sort of academia per se. Speaking of academia, one of the things that's very disturbing right now is that several of the Cal State schools around the state of California are bringing cuts in for their different departments. And one of the departments that's at the top of the list already happened in Sonoma State, is already being threatened here in Cal State LA, is gender and women's studies. You know, whatever they're called now, they all have slightly different name, women and gender studies. And they are on the chopping block. And I feel like those are places where young people, not just young women, young people of all kinds are coming in and for the first time learning to critically think and reading some of the, you know, the classic books. And it's really so disheartening. And it's also for those schools, many of those schools, the students are first generation kids who are stepping into this whole new world.
One of the things you're mentioning, which I think is a real key to women's history, is the concept of empowerment. Mm-hmm. Not only do we need those women from whose shoulders we stand on as role models, but we need to see something in their lives that we can identify with. And for boys, too, to appreciate the lives that women have. I think it would be a much, much better society if they had an equal voice. And that's what we learn in gender studies. You know, if somebody asked me once, what am I going to do with gender studies? I said, well, you're going to be more aware. You're going to like yourself as much, much more, too, and find your own potentials. And women in science, I think, are fabulous, and women are finally starting to be coders and find language for women's language. Remember, the writers of Virginia Woolf tried to find how do I write a novel? I only know male language, you know?
Right.
And so now they're doing it in other areas as well. It's
right.
Very exciting, and I think even these blocks, these challenges, they take it away. They can't take it away from us, you know, they can't.
I love your determination. I really do. Yeah.
And we have to say that. In fact, I always go into a bank and I say, "Do you have a Susan B. Anthony silver dollar?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have one of the women's quarters?" And they say, "Oh, I don't know. Who is Susan B. Anthony?" You know? And you can just teach them with one sentence and they're better for it. So
yeah, so where are you now with the National Women's History Alliance? What is the sense of where it's going and what directions to grow in?
Well, the Alliance is much more grassroots than the Smithsonian Museum or the National Women's History Museum. They're national kinds of, they do big events and lots of, but we work with some, if you were in a little town, let's say, and you wanted to have a library exhibit of books, you know, you could call the Alliance and people would get back to you, or you could give presentations. We have resources on our and workbooks and toolkits and all that kind of stuff, all free, of course. We just finished a really nice magazine that's downloadable there, and that's at our website, www.nationalwomenshistory.org. A big word, I'm sorry, but it's all one word. And if you just Google women's history something, you'll find it. But I think that we do these things every day, and people don't know how they could be involved with it. But even ask your library, do you have a book on what's your recommendation? You know, mm-hmm, librarians mm-hmm. love to tell us that, you know?
They absolutely do, yeah. And I think in these times when you're seeing the museums, all of the federal institutions censoring, slicing and cutting, what seems to be like, it seems like they're using AI to just go in and take out dangerous words, which is sheer fascism, is the moment when we have to appreciate even more grassroots organizations, local libraries, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we also can't be afraid to thank somebody for supporting women. And mm-hmm. by that, I mean not only employing and supporting women's businesses, but when I hear anything that somebody says, well, a woman did that, you know, mm-hmm. I thank them. And I even wrote Costco the other day because they did not cave to DEI.
Right.
You know, so let's be happy when somebody that was good for you, you know, whatever it is. So,
right. Yeah, there's a very short list of of corporations who have not caved. This kind of like immediate compliance. And when you actually look at this list of federal agencies like the Department of Defense and the CIA, and not that any of them are actually our friends, but still, they're, you know, powerful and very large. And the words, you know, Black History Month and Women's History Month were not actually in the executive order, but they automatically just complied. They interpreted it in the most extreme way, and they just canceled all of these things.
They were cautionary. But notice, all, you know, who are the wonderful ones in the parks?
The parks.
And before he left office, Biden said, I want the national parks to amplify the voices of women who are, and women were very involved because they could do that. It was in their neighborhood. They could get, you know, they could save the redwoods and things like that. And they were very much a part of that. And they were volunteers, you know, of course, to get good help from women as volunteers in the park service, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, the national parks have actually been doing amazing things. Well, so March 8th, it's actually International Women's Day.
Anything that you know, Pacifica can post on it is good, because we can't get tired. We just can't get tired. We got to keep going.
Right.
And they make a difference. They're visible. And visibility, of course, when we make women's voices and women's what they've done more visible, we learn two things. We learn to trust them because we can see them. We have never had a woman president because we've never seen one. And two of them down is just too many, too many, actually. But the second thing is it reduces bias, I think. When we see them doing the same thing that ordinary men do, or better than, people don't get afraid of them, and it reduces an unknown quality which they don't know that they have, you know. So
right, absolutely, yeah. I mean, and as you mentioned in one of our earlier conversations, this is very much about the fear of loss of power, of the fear of the power that patriarchy gives to the kind of men that are now currently running our country. So it's all part of the resistance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It really is.
And we do have to, we are on the brink of something pretty big, which is the creation of a new society, of a society where if we can hold on, we can make it more equal. We can make it more interesting and more compassionate and kinder and deeper for all of us, I think. And
for all of us, absolutely. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. We've been talking to Martha Wheelock, who is an educator, documentary filmmaker, and current president of the National Women's History Alliance. And we've been talking about Women's History Month, which is still here, which is still going to keep being here. In fact, it's all year round. And we are very happy to have had you on the show today.
Can I add one more thing?
For sure.
My film company is called Wild West Women, which you .org, and you won't forget that. But through my website, you can see films on Inez Milholland, the whole story of the women's suffrage movement, the story of how California women won the vote. They're all on YouTube. They're all free. And take a time, you know, out of all the other harassment that might happen around your head, to celebrate Women's History Month, and may it be a good one for you. And don't forget to ask for those women's quarters and the Susan B. Anthony dollars and say, where are the women? And say her name.
Absolutely. Thanks, Lynn. Thank you. We'll make sure to post